week. It's Good News Week.
Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Do you sometimes feel like we're drowning in bad news? Have you ever come back from vacation when you weren't paying attention to the news and started reading the news again online or in the paper? It really strikes you how negative most of the news is. Headlines show how celebrity-obsessed we are and how focused the media are on the sensational, the lurid, and shocking things that go on. Good news can be hard to find, but there's certainly plenty of it out there. You just have to look for it. That's why on American Variety we have an occasional series that I call Good News Week. It's just me, without a guest, reading stories from around the country and the world that are upbeat, interesting, inspiring, or in some cases just goofy and kind of silly, in a good way. Now, the theme of American Variety is actually an anti-theme, anything but politics. If you're like me, you've had about enough of politics lately, so I thought some good news was in order for today's show. I'm going to start with something. There was a TV show back in, I don't know, the early 60s, I think, called Kids Say the Darndest Things. And the host was a guy named Art Linkletter. And he was great at having, you know, little kids on and somehow getting them to say, well, the darndest things, like really funny, ridiculously silly things. Here's an example. Moses led the Hebrew slaves to the Red Sea, where they made unleavened bread, which is bread made without any ingredients. Moses went up on Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandos. He died before he ever reached Canada, but the Commandos made it. Julius Caesar extinguished himself on the battlefields of Gaul. The Ides of March murdered him because they thought he was going to be made king. Dying, he gasped out, "Same to you, Brutus." So these must not be things they said kind of like ad lib. These must be things they wrote down, I guess. Got a bunch more of them. Joan of Arc was burnt to a stake, S-T-E-A-K, and was canonized by Bernard Shaw for reasons I don't really understand. The English and the French still have problems. Here's one. Queen Elizabeth was the Virgin Queen. As a queen, she was a success. When she exposed herself before her troops, they all shouted, "Hurrah!" And that was the end of the fighting for a long while. It was an age of great inventions and discoveries. Gutenberg invented removable type and the Bible. Another important invention was the circulation of blood. Sir Francis Drake circumcised the world with a 100-foot clipper, which was very dangerous to all his men. I guess so. The greatest writer of the Renaissance was William Shakespeare. He was born in the year 1564, supposedly on his birthday. He never made much money, and is famous only because of his plays. He wrote tragedies, comedies, and hysterectomies, all in Islamic pentameter. Writing at the same time as Shakespeare was Miguel Cervantes. He wrote Don Quixote. The next great author was John Milton. Milton wrote Paradise Lost. Since then, no one has ever found it. That's true, I guess. Delegates from the original 13 states formed the Contented Congress. Thomas Jefferson, a virgin, and Benjamin Franklin were two singers of the Declaration of Independence. Franklin discovered electricity by rubbing two cats backward and also declared, "A horse divided against itself cannot stand." He was a naturalist for sure. Franklin died in 1790 and is still dead. Abraham Lincoln became America's greatest president, P-R-E-C-E-D-E-N-T. Lincoln's mother died in infancy, and he was born in a log cabin, which he built with his own hands. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves by signing the Emasculation Proclamation. God. On the night of April 14th, 1865, Lincoln went to the theater and got shot in his seat by one of the actors in a moving picture show. They believed the assassinator was John Wilkes Booth, a supposedly insane actor. This ruined Booth's career. At least that. So I'm going to go on reading from a lot of stories that are posted on a site called heroicstories.com. And I have the permission of the owner of that website to read these stories on my show. So it's www.heroicstories.com. And these are really all in the category of kindness of strangers. This is called Redemption from the Mud, and it was sent in by Mary Malone from Washington State. I was prepared for the worst. I had water, gloves, and tools to scrape the mud, garbage bags in which to put the broken picture frames, tables to set out the photos, but I wasn't prepared for what I saw when I opened the first bag. I had volunteered for cleanup efforts from the flood in Centralia, Washington, in December 2007. A gal named Catherine had sent a volunteer to my home with photos, 4 bags and 2 boxes. The bags were mostly full of pictures in frames, old 70s high school pictures, a black and white or two, and lots of snapshots. I was amazed to see that under an inch of mud they weren't destroyed. Water really isn't an enemy to pictures. They are developed in liquids, and as long as they don't dry out in this condition, they can be cleaned and made right again. I started on the first pile. I had glimpsed a black and white in the bag and thought I ought to start on the oldest ones first. I had to break the frames in order to get the swollen cardboard backings off. As I peeled, rinsed, and scraped the mud, I got down to the glass in the picture. As I slid my putty knife along the edge of the glass, there appeared an old gentleman in a gray flannel hat with a distinguished-looking mustache. The photo was in nearly perfect condition. Encouraged, I plunged onward, releasing brides and grooms, babies with moms, and school-aged children from their muddy prisons. What I was not prepared for as my tables filled up with faces was the surge of raw emotion I felt as I looked on decades of photos nearly destroyed by the raging waters of winter rains. It broke my heart that, though these pictures were now relatively safe, many others were lost to their mud-covered sepulchres. A lesson came to me clearly. If your pictures of your family are precious to you, treat them like family. Don't store them on the ground floor if you live close to water of any kind. Make duplicates and store them off-site in a safe deposit box or a relative's home. Of course, now we'd store them on our cell phones and they'd be in the cloud. And don't print your pictures at home. I know we all do it, but don't let that be the only copy. Pictures printed by professional developers can be rinsed and cleaned without fear of ruining the photo. Photos printed at home wouldn't be all right after sitting in mud for days. In fact, they wouldn't be there at all. The first night I rinsed and rinsed for about 5 hours. My counters and 4 tables were full of faces I knew nothing about. Families I don't know, children who had grown up with their own children, water skiers, cruises, boat rides, Mustangs, Harleys, babies, grandparents, toddlers, and toys. But mostly, my tables were full of hope for rebuilding. This one's called Three Penny Mama, sent in by Don Creasy in Kentucky. The year was 1958, and I was 7 years old when I first met my mama. It's not important how we 3 children fell into the child care system, nor how we came to live at that orphanage. Simply stated, the man our birth mother had run off with didn't want to raise 3 hungry children after she was killed in a car accident. So there we were. I vividly remember holding each sister's hand through a chain-link fence, separated on the boys' and girls' sides. It remains important that we 3 children stayed close. One day they got us all fixed up and took us to the courthouse to see the judge. To ensure good behavior, the social worker gave me 3 pennies for the gumball machine, if we were good. When we arrived, they walked us right past the gumball machine and, to our great joy, into a room with our biological dad. The judge told me, as the oldest, that if I wanted, we could go with our dad and the new mama he had for us. I looked her over, a large, sweet-smelling, pillowy woman in a flowery dress. I reached into my pocket, pulled out those 3 pennies, and asked her, "If I give you these 3 pennies, will you take care of them?" Somehow she understood I meant a different kind of question. She replied, "Yes, honey, I will." I turned to the judge and told him we would go with her. For the next 25 years, she cooked and cleaned and slung hash at the Calico Kitchen all night long, only to come home to 3 more hungry mouths. She wasn't perfect. I don't know anyone who is. But she raised and reared us when necessary. Finally, we were all 3 out of the house and married and raising families of our own. Life was good. Then Dad chose to leave with another woman. We kids were devastated. I wanted to show Mama my support, love, and appreciation for all her gifts and sacrifices. I wrote her a letter and told her that no matter what happened or what anyone else in the world did, she would always be our Mama. To emphasize my point, I taped 3 shiny new pennies into a card and sent it to her. She called. "I don't need 3 pennies to remember you children. Besides, I still have the first 3. That was 15 years ago. Mama died this spring. We buried her on Good Friday. But because of her, we will never again be motherless children. As we sorted her things out, I opened her jewelry box drawer. There, in tiny individual plastic bags, lay 3 pennies, dated 1957, 1957, and 1958. I have them in my pocket at this moment. No one will ever make a movie or write a book about her. But to me and my sisters, she's the world's best 3-penny mama. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and again, we're reading stories from heroicstories.com, and this is Good News Week, and we're telling you some stories about the kindness of strangers. This is called Lauren Listened by Harold Spriggs in Illinois. My life was transformed in 2010 when I was 15 years old on a mission trip with my church youth group. We were in Kansas City, Missouri, building the foundation of a house for Habitat for Humanity. I was very shy then. Halfway through the week and halfway through one day, I was tired. We were working in hot sun, loading rebar from a warehouse into our pickup truck for our work site. After the truck was loaded, I jumped up into the rear with my friends. At the building site, I was about to leap from the back of the truck when our pastor began to back up. I lost my balance and fell hard on the blacktop. For a moment, I wondered if I'd died. When I got up, a man nearby on his front porch laughed at me. That was hard to hear. My self-esteem fell, too. The rest of the day, I worked with my head a little lower than usual and didn't say much. After work, we returned to the church where we were staying for dinner. Then the girls in our group showed us a bag system for leaving encouraging notes to each other. That night, I stayed up late in the kitchen working on notes to my friends. Lauren, whom I had known for a year, sat next to me and asked how I was doing. I could tell she really cared and began saying more about my feelings than I expected. I was discouraged about falling earlier that day and remembered my Aunt Marion, who had died a year earlier after falling down her basement stairs. With Lauren keeping me company, I cried. Once I calmed down, Lauren told me some things I'd longed to hear. She said, "Don't worry about tomorrow, for that is in the future. Worry about this minute. What's going on now? It's okay to let your guard down every now and then to open up to me and the rest of our group. You'd feel a lot better if you would. It's not going to be easy to say goodbye to you at the end of this week, but I know our friendship will last. You're a great kid, Harold. You just have to find yourself and accept yourself the way you are." That Friday night, our last in Kansas City, I took Lauren's advice. I told the group about my aunt and how I missed her. For the first time, I felt better, like everything would be okay. I was really thinking about running away that Friday night. I didn't think anyone wanted me around, so I was going to run. I look back now and know I would have regretted it all my life and may have ended up worse off, possibly in jail. Just when I wanted to disappear out of hurt and embarrassment, someone helped me reach out to others. Thank you, Lauren. Your lesson has stayed with me ever since. Here's one called Artist in Residence, sent in by David McLachlan from Scotland. Once upon another life, I worked on the building of an oil rig. Three steel tanks, each 300 foot tall and 50 feet wide, would be joined by a latticework of pipes. The living accommodation platform would go on top, and the tanks would eventually be sunk in the icy waters of the North Sea. For most of the year, the sun rose and set while I was at work. We worked 12-hour shifts in a bleak industrial landscape. The work was hard, the men were harder. Often coming home at the end of the day, it was a struggle to find myself again, to remember I was a young husband and new father. The job paid the bills, but it fairly scoured the soul. I was part of a team of four junior engineers. Mostly we were gophers and holders for the big boys. As part of our toolkits, we had magnetic clamps, two square magnets on an aluminum strip handle like big brackets, and paint pens like giant toothpaste tubes full of paint with a ballpoint on the end so you could write technical data on the metal. When we weren't needed for anything or when the weather was too foul, we retired to our, quote, office. One of my workmates, Wooly, would come into the porta cabin we inhabited on his tea break. He would open the door of his metal locker and pull a battered plastic chair behind it. Still in his waterproofs and wearing his safety helmet and boots, Wooly would take out a piece of canvas. Using the magnetic clamps, he would fix his canvas to the inside of his locker door. Until they got used to him, folk would give Wooly some strange looks and make less than charitable comments. Wooly's response was always a smile and a kind word. Using a piece of scrap iron as a palette, Wooly would start mixing the paint from the different colored paint pens. Then, for the 10 minutes he had left, he would take paintbrushes from his locker and lose himself in his painting. While his workmates boasted about their sexual conquests or how much they'd drunk at the weekend, Wooly created works of art. As we were on the Atlantic coast, with the Western Isles nearby, he painted seascapes. Why do I remember this? Because I envied Wooly. And in a way, he got me through the whole experience. I never saw him again after the rig was built, but 20-some years later I still think of him with admiration. He taught me there was beauty everywhere. There never was a bleaker place than that construction site, but Wooly managed to find beauty in it. He found it by making it. Here's one titled, You Never Know Who. It was sent in by Chuck Keller from Missouri. We'd moved to St. Louis, but the Veterans Administration, or VA, said if I wanted to stay in queue, I'd better get myself to the appointment I'd made at the VA medical facility in Marion, Indiana. So after work, I drove the 5 hours to Marion. While I sat in the waiting room, another man sat down beside me. He started talking. He said he was a Marine. He still looked strong at about 60, had sandy brown hair, which was graying, and a quiet voice. His right eye was gone, and the face and skull around it were deformed because of an obviously horrible injury. I didn't ask how or what happened, because some of us don't like to talk about or remember such things. What I did ask was if he was in Vietnam. He said he was. I asked when. He said 18 months in 1967 and 68. That's when I was there, so we began to talk about places and things. He was in recon, which is tough and dangerous work. We talked about the troops in Iraq and the PTSD they face. We talked about how loud noises still make us jump after 40 years. Recently in a store, someone dropped an empty pallet behind me that hit the concrete floor with a very loud bang. My heart stopped, as it always does when I hear sounds like that. He nodded in agreement. We discussed a woman's son back from Iraq for July 4th. He formerly enjoyed fireworks immensely, but couldn't stand them now. That'll be a sad and profound fact of life for many people returning after service in this war. I asked if he'd made it to Da Nang. He said that's where they took him when he was hit and lost his eye. That was the third time he was wounded, so it finally sent him home. I told him I might have carried him off the chopper and taken care of him before his surgery. I was a Navy corpsman at Da Nang Hospital in the receiving unit. We ran out to the choppers, took the wounded into our Quonset hut, and tried to save their lives. We stopped bleeding, started IVs, stabilized them long enough to give them a chance to live, and prepared them for surgery. When it was my time to see the doctor, I told him Semper Fi and walked away. After seeing the doctor, I came out, and the Marine and I happened to walk along side by side for a minute. He said, "Doc, if you are the one who carried me and saved my life, thanks." I just nodded, and our paths parted. I hadn't felt better than that in a long time. That former Marine said something else very profound during our conversation. You never know who the drunk sitting at the bar might be, or the homeless guy on the corner. He might have saved your life once. He was right. Again, I'm reading stories from heroicstories.com. It's a website you can go to, and there are lots of stories like this of good news about people helping people. This one's called Take a Moment. It's by Christine, and she lives in California. They say the average work commute in the USA is 24 miles daily. Well, try commuting in Metro Los Angeles with 15 million other people, where every mile feels like 10. Too much sitting in traffic wears your patience thin, and after 8 years, cutting people off had become reflexive for me. Driving home from work during rush hour in spring 2012, I was running on fumes from sitting on the freeway. I stopped to fill up at the cheapest nearby gas station, which is difficult to drive out of. You have to cross a right-turn-only lane onto a major road. During green lights, people rush by at over 35 miles an hour. At red lights, people pack in behind the light, effectively blocking any chance to infiltrate the throng. The only way across was to gun it while turning into your lane, crossing the right turn lane in the process. And I was heading home after a doctor appointment at the worst possible time to drive, especially near five colleges, with students in the midst of finals. After filling up, I was poised to make my sudden dash for the northbound lane when the guy behind me started honking insistently. I glanced back in my side mirror and saw an unshaven, bushy-haired 20-something driving an ancient Toyota, a college kid car. I couldn't discern what color the paint had been. The rear windshield was covered with Rock Band stickers. No doubt he wanted to turn right, and I was in his way, so I thought, he'll just have to wait. Though not yet 30, I didn't want to move for this scruffy kid in a beat-up car. Imagine my surprise when I saw the kid, complete with torn-up jeans and Rock Band t-shirt, jump out of his car, jog up to my rear end, grab the gas cap sitting on my trunk lid, and twist it into place, close the gas flap, and jog back to his car. It only took a moment. I was floored and ashamed. I got a goofy grin and started waving to him energetically, but I don't know if he saw, because he was turning right. Even better, people in the northbound and right turn lanes, whose attention had been grabbed by the honking, paused in their scramble and let me out. For years since, whenever I'm at that gas station pulling out, I think about that guy. Was he on his way to final exams? Did he make it in time? He could have just handed me the cap. It seemed so much to do for an ungrateful stranger. I now make a conscious effort to let people into traffic. And I've seen those people let other people in, all thanks to that thoughtful college kid. That's one person's small conscious act of kindness spreading geometrically, making busy, preoccupied people take a moment, wake up, and think beyond themselves. A little bit sure does go a long way. This is called Rainstorm. It was sent in by Janet Hounsell from New Hampshire. I live in a small New England village. One summer's day, I drove slowly along our main street as a horrendous and sudden summer shower threatened. The sky darkened and the wind whipped around warningly. I pulled to the side of the street. A rusticating pickup truck pulled ahead of me into the next parking place. Open to the weather in its body were what were obviously the family's entire belongings, mattresses on end, baskets and boxes of clothing and other household goods. Oh my, those poor people, I thought, observing children in the seat of the truck cab. They were obviously moving from one home to another, and their belongings, humble though they were going to get soaked. Just then a little old lady whipped by me and into the variety store before which we were all parked to wait out the storm. In minutes she was out again, tearing the wrapping from a package containing a huge sheet of plastic. She busily rapped on the window of the truck and motioned the woman driver out, and between them they whipped that covering over the entire load in the body of the truck. Rain now came down in torrents, and the wind whipped around in a demented fashion. Fighting the gale, the two women managed to weigh down the plastic sheet's corners and edges, thereby providing protection for the little family's belongings. Everyone back inside their vehicles, we sat out the brief storm. The sun broke out in all its splendor. I rolled down my window as the little old lady and the young mother emerged to meet at the rear of the pickup, and I heard the wizened and soaking wet little old lady say, "Don't thank me, just pass it on when you have the opportunity." Well, I hope you're enjoying these stories from heroicstories.com. They are kind of heartwarming. Here's one called So Many Wonderful People, sent in by Jackie from Texas. In December of 2012, I moved away from my family and friends to Texas with my fiancé. When we broke off the engagement in June 2013, I decided to keep my job and stay in town, even though I still had trouble making any lasting friends. My ex-fiancé decided to let me use the car we shared, it was in his name, until I was able to buy my own car, hopefully in about a month. However, 3 months later, the company I worked for cut the commission rates so effectively that my paychecks were half what they'd been. I struggled to stay on top of my bills. Worst of all, I was still relying on my ex to drive me everywhere. He was understanding until one day I didn't pick him up from work. He stopped talking to me and refused to drive me to work the next day. I set off on the 5-mile trek to my workplace at 6 a.m. the following morning. An hour later, I was almost there, but tired and unsure if I would make it. My asthma and heart condition were not advantageous in the situation. Suddenly, a car pulled over, and a friendly woman on the passenger side asked if I needed a ride. Hot, tired, and looking forward to 8 hours at work, I agreed to get in. She and her husband drove me to work, and when I got out, thanking them over and over, they told me just to pay it forward. I told them I'd never forget their kindness and went into work. Two young girls fresh out of high school, Ashley and Chelsea, saw my sweaty face when I went to the bathroom to freshen up and asked if I'd just been in the exercise room. I told them no, I'd walked from home because I didn't have a car. I knew them because they sat a few desks over but didn't talk to them much. At once, Ashley said it was unacceptable for me to walk to work and said she'd drive me to and from work from then on. After I got home that day, I sat on my balcony contemplating the long walk to the grocery store and whether I had the strength for it. My neighbor, who shared the balcony, came outside and we started talking. He offered to take me to the grocery store that day and every week until I had a car. When I left for work that morning, I was unsure whether I'd be able to keep my job and trying to decide whether to move back into my parents' house. By the end of the day, I'd met so many wonderful people I knew I didn't need to move at all. I procured a car and am now doing fine. All that is thanks to one day where a group of people I barely knew all came together to help a disillusioned little me. This one's called I Just Got to Thinking by R. Thompson in Colorado. My dad and I were hunting in the mountains surrounding Gunnison, Colorado. It was September 2013, and we were on a dirt access road to the wilderness area. Few people knew of this road. As my dad and I drove to our drop-off location, we saw an older hunter with vehicle trouble. We stopped, and from the look on his face, I knew there was serious trouble. He had tried to cross a ditch-like road depression. His radiator had flexed in its mounting brackets, and its top had popped off. All we could offer was a ride out to get a new radiator in town, 30 miles each way. We thought of getting a tow truck, but the man mentioned he probably didn't have enough money for that. My dad had an idea, though. I would continue to hunt from our drop-off point, and he'd take the man and the broken radiator to town for repair. My dad didn't mind helping the elderly man. I remember my dad always telling me to help out where you can, even if there isn't a promise of reward or expression of gratitude. Know that it always comes back when you may need it most. I hunted the rest of the day, but a hitch in the story developed in town. All the parts stores were closed. It was Sunday and hunting season. My dad took the man and the damaged radiator to a friend who had a garage. Dad thought he could solder a temporary patch on the radiator and get the truck to town for a more lasting repair. The repair was made, the truck was fixed, the man drove off to town, and my dad returned to the planned pickup point for me. When I arrived, he told me what had happened, and we planned for tomorrow's hunt as we drove back to town for the night. As we approached the outskirts of Gunnison, there alongside the road was the old man's pickup. We guessed the repair hadn't worked, so we slowed down as we came closer. The old man stepped out from in front of the truck and waved us down. I rolled down my window and my dad asked if the repair had failed. "Nope," the old man said. "I just got to thinking while I drove that I really hadn't thanked you for all you've done for me, so I just pulled over and waited for you to come by. Boys, I'm buying you dinner tonight." We followed him to his favorite cafe. As we drove behind him, my dad and I had to think on this. That old man must have waited beside the road for over 3 hours to catch us coming back into town so he could buy us dinner. It was that important to him to express his gratitude for what my dad had done. If you really are committed to making a gesture of thanks, nothing will stop you. I think I'll read a few more from Art Linkletter's old show, Kids Say the Darndest Thing, because they were kind of funny. Here we're getting into music. Johann Bach wrote a great many musical compositions and had a large number of children. In between, he practiced on an old spinster, which he kept up in his attic. Bach died from 1970 to the present. Bach was the most famous composer in the world, and so was Handel. Handel was half German, half Italian, and half English. He was very large. Beethoven wrote music even though he was deaf. He was so deaf that he wrote loud music and became the father of rock and roll. He took long walks in the forest even when everyone was calling for him. Beethoven expired in 1827 and later died for this. And finally, the 19th century was a time of a great many thoughts and inventions. People stopped reproducing by hand and started reproducing by machine. The invention of the steamboat caused a network of rivers to spring up. Another inventor then, Cyrus McCormick, invented the McCormick Raper, which did the work of 100 men. Louis Pasteur discovered a cure for rabbits, but I don't know why. And I guess we're going to leave it there. I hope you've enjoyed our little venture into Good News Week. These have been some heartwarming stories. I hope you found them to be that too. And again, go to www.heroicstories.com and there are more of these kinds of things. I want to thank you for listening to American Variety Radio. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio. It's Good News Week.